I'm John, he's Patrick. Together we're the functional nerds. I'm John, he's Patrick. Together we're the functional nerds. Together we're the functional nerds.
And John, there are certain things that I feel that I should be recognized for. And when I'm not recognized for them, it really upsets me. And I think I did a damn fine Count Dooku voice.
You did.
In our last episode.
I agree.
And like no one mentioned it anywhere.
You know what we'll have to do is we'll have to make a little audio clip of it and put it out there.
Just put it in a loop.
Yeah, put it in a loop. I thought it was quite good. So yeah, you do a good Count Dooku. I've been watching Clone Wars.
That was my first attempt.
Yeah, I know. And I've had a couple of Count Dooku episodes of Clone Wars that my son and I just got through. So, and that guy does a good Christopher Lee, whoever's doing the voice on that show, he does a very good job. But very good. Hello, everybody. I'm John Anilio, and that's Patrick Hester. And today we're joined by Jerry Gordon. Jerry's got a new book out that he's here to let us know about. And Jerry, thanks.
What the L, John? What the L?
Exactly.
You forgot the L. I believe he goes by Jerry L.
Oh, I'm sorry. You're right. Well, Jerry L. Gordon, I'm just going to call you by your full name all episodes today. Thank you for joining us, Jerry.
Hey, it's great to be here. Actually, it is just Jerry Gordon.
It is just Jerry Gordon now? You don't use the L?
No. I have it on Twitter, mainly because there's an elderly gentleman who apparently was first on Twitter, who never posts, has no photo, but he's staying. So wow. I went with the Jerry L. Gordon on Twitter.
Okay.
You know, it's funny with Twitter, with the names, because I think that at one point there was... Everyone wanted to have a kind of a cutesy Twitter handle that wasn't like their real name. And then I think people sort of realized that it's probably better just to have your real name or as close to your real name as possible on there.
I have absolutely no idea what you're talking about.
Well, I know that's not – well, yours actually works out well because yours is only five letters. So that's easy to remember.
That may have been on purpose.
I know.
And when you go to the names though, John, no one uses them anymore. They all put weird – things in their names now, like whatever their Twitter handle is, they put all kinds of weird shit in their names and you can never find them.
Right, there's a lot of that going on. And but that's not the actual address of their name though. That doesn't change. They just sort of like change the name, not the Twitter address. But
yeah.
I think at one point there was a lot of like Dr. Cutesy Pants Unicorn or you know whatever, and then people realize I should do that. But Jerry Gordon, kind of a common name, so probably have some things with it. So I imagine that's the...
There are about 300 of us circling the globe.
Ah.
It's fairly common. Actually, when I first started writing and joining kind of the online community, the big thing was some cutesy picture for your avatar. And I actually just used a picture of myself, which turned out to be hugely useful mm-hmm. when I went to my first kind of big writing convention and didn't know anybody. And was literally putting my hotel card key in the door, and down the hallway, a editor named Pete Allen was like, "Jerry, I didn't know you were going to be here." And what? Put your bags away. Come over here. Let me introduce you to Gary Brombeck and Lucy Snyder, who are going to introduce you to a bunch of other people. And you know, it was so it really worked out for me to actually be visually linked to the account.
The problem that I ran into, though, is that everybody kept going, "Where's your hat?"
Yep. Yeah, people were. Yeah, I still always sort of envision you with the hat half the time when we go out, even though I know you don't really wear the hat at all anymore. Never really wore the hat a lot. It was just kind of a thing.
I wear the hat in the mountains. So right. When I go to the mountains is when I wear the hat because it's cold up there.
Mm-hmm.
Now are people surprised that you have hair? Because a lot of people who do the hat thing with the, you know, they're, you know.
If they are, they're not saying anything to me.
Oh, okay.
No, Patrick, you have a fantastic head of hair.
You do.
And you know what? It's a regret of mine because my hair is thinning and thinning. And I remember Matt Wallace when I met him at a Balticon many years ago now. That was one of his takeaways. It's like, that John Anilio, he's got a fantastic head of hair, and I do not have a fantastic head of hair anymore. That was 7 years ago me. Now it's quite thinning, and I cut it very short to try to mask the fact that I don't have as much hair. But anyway, hair talk aside, yeah, no, I one of my regrets is that my email isn't my name. My email is kind of a weird thing, because when I was trying to decide on how I wanted to release music, I had this idea that I was going to have some sort of Nine Inch Nails like kind of name for the project that I was doing. And I scrapped that idea because I'm like, well, what if I get interviewed? Are people going to call me like by that name? Like, I want them to call them my, so I changed it. But my email is this weird like number and all this weird stuff that made sense 10 years ago when I put it together, but now it doesn't mean anything. And when I give out my email address, I'm sort of embarrassed because I sort of give that to people in real life a lot.
I actually
see if I could change that. But anyway,
I actually got a gig when I'm not writing and editing, I do software work. And I actually got a gig from somebody based on my email address, which is just jerrygordon@gmail.com. So there's nothing special about it, but most people with a common name can't get that. And I got asked about it, and the conversation ensued and turned into a gig.
What used to drive me crazy in a previous life was I would be working with these older folks in the real estate industry, and their email address was whoever their current internet service provider was, like whatever that basic, you know, when you sign up for internet, they give you an email address that you never, ever check.
Yeah.
That was their email address. And so, and they would change their internet every time their contract ran up. So then they'd be like, well, my email's not working. Well, yeah. Do you have Comcast? No, I've switched to blah, 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 blah. Oh, well then, yeah, you lost that email address. Well, why would I lose that email address? Because you no longer pay for the service. They totally never got that. And it used to drive me up a wall.
Well, Jerry is here to join us because he's got a new book out, or it's coming out. I think it's coming out in April. So, Jerry, why don't you tell us when the book's coming out and give our listeners a little snapshot of what they can expect from this book.
Sure. Well, Breaking the World is an alternate history apocalyptic thriller. It takes place during the 51-day standoff between the federal government and the Branch Davidian Church in Waco, Texas. The book's actually going to be released on April 19th. Which is the 25th anniversary of that standoff. For those of you out there listening that aren't familiar with the Branch Davidians or David Koresh, Koresh was the pastor of a small Christian church in Waco, Texas, that was raided by the federal government. In 1993...
Janet Reno.
Yeah, Janet Reno, FBI, ATF. You know, when you talk about the idea of law enforcement raiding, what I usually think of is like Law and Order SVU, like six guys in bulletproof, armor with, you know, handguns, that sort of thing. This was a much larger operation. There were over 100 ATF agents that stormed the church in full body armor, guns drawn.
I remember all this. This was huge.
Yeah. Military helicopters were deployed in the raid. Encircled overhead as church members and the law enforcement agents traded gunfire. When the smoke cleared, there were four government agents and six church members dead, and a 51-day standoff between the government and the church followed that, and that's the setting of the book. Inside that setting, the story follows three atheist teenagers that are basically they're non-believers that were dragged to the church by their born-again parents. And when the government raid goes horribly wrong, the teens find themselves branded as cult members and caught between soon-to-be infamous David Koresh, an erratic FBI, and a pandemic that seems to confirm the worst of the church's apocalyptic prophecies.
Wow.
Yeah, that's a great setting for a book, because that was a huge story when that was all breaking. I remember that was just on the news every night. And Jerry, let me ask you a question. I might be confusing this with another news story of the time. Was this the one where they were also doing like the noise where they were like blasting like heavy metal music at them? Did that go on too? Like, and is that any part of this novel?
Yeah. The thing you're talking about is the FBI brought in some, I'm going to put this in air quotes for everybody, cult experts to kind of help them understand what was going on the inside of this church during the standoff. And the cult experts basically pitched the idea that David Koresh had mind control powers over these people that needed to be disrupted. And the way to disrupt it was they basically hit the compound with massive spotlights 24/7 and played hugely loud rock and roll music, sounds of animals being killed, just all kinds of crazy stuff 24 hours a day.
Yeah, wow. I would be really curious to read, because I've totally forgot about that. And I don't know if that's a technique that they use in these kinds of situations, because I feel like that's come up another place too, but do remember.
Yeah, they did it in Guantanamo Bay as well to keep prisoners from sleeping.
Yeah, that's rough. But now, Jerry, I imagine, or maybe you could tell us, has this been an idea that's sort of been coagulating in your mind for 25 years to write a book about this? Or what was the, you know, sort of inciting thing that made you finally sit down and write a book like this?
Yeah, there's a really long road between the book that people are going to read and the start of this. I'm old enough to remember, and this was a 51-day standoff, so every night on television was an update for this.
This is right when CNN kind of hit it big and we started having the 24-hour news cycle, and this was all
So 24 hours a day, this was just running over and over again. And my memories of the actual event are really entrenched in that coverage. And when I say entrenched, what I mean is the news media was kept almost 2 miles away from the actual site. The FBI said that was for their safety. But what that basically meant for news media is the only reporting came in the form of FBI briefings as to what was going on. So there was no kind of counter to the official story whatsoever. And I had no reason to question it at all. And
weren't they trying to do like telephoto lenses and all this kind of stuff to try to get video, and they were doing all kinds of crazy stuff, right?
Oh yeah. Yeah. You can actually go on YouTube and search for video from CNN and you'll see basically a huge telephoto shot in the distance. There's actually one point during the standoff where the Branch Davidians, they still had access to television at the time. And so they knew that CNN could see them with these giant lenses, and they unfurled a banner out of an upper story window, basically pleading for an audience with the press to tell their side of the story. So, it was very one-sided, in its portrayal. And it's 25 years ago, so 25 years later, there's a lot more information available about what happened than we would have ever had access to at that previous point. But the real start of this story for me, I was on a late night road trip with my girlfriend, who's now my wife, and we listened to an NPR.
Congratulations.
Thank you. We were listening to an NPR interview with a forensic anthropologist named Dr. Emily Craig. And she was a forensic anthropologist in the aftermath of Waco. So after the fire, she identified bodies, she determined cause of death. And in the course of the interview, she mentioned a fact that was so counter to what I understood to be the event that it stuck with me. For those of you who aren't aware, in the actual historic event, the majority of the people die in a fire at the end of it. The kind of basic narrative from the FBI point of view is that they tear gassed these people. They didn't want to leave, and so they set themselves on fire and killed themselves. That's the basic narrative of it.
Oh wow!
From the government point of view, the actual history event. So I'm listening to this forensic anthropologist, and that's my vision of what happened. And what she explains is that after an examination of the bodies, a full third of the congregation did not die in the fire.
Whoa.
A full third of the congregation were murdered at point blank range with contact gunshot wounds to the head.
Wow.
And you would assume that would then follow with there must have been some issue with the church internally, but actually the forensic anthropologist went way out of her way to basically categorize this as an unsolved murder scene.
Whoa, that's a trip.
And that just blew me away. And so a couple years later, I was commissioned to write a short story. I'd done an anthology with another writer named Maurice Broaddus called the anthology was called
Dark.
Yeah, exactly. Who? Maurice, we toast to you. Anytime Maurice is mentioned on the internet, he perks up and listens. So,
yeah, I know.
But I'd done an anthology with him that was called Dark Faith, and I was commissioned to write this short story. And really, the only kind of guidance I'd been given was they wanted me to write a short story that dealt with faith in some dark way. And so I decided that I wanted to tell a story about somebody who had absolutely no faith, that they were just completely shattered by the entire idea of religion, and play with the idea of, could you take a story like that and slowly make a person like that believe that maybe they were here to save everybody? So that was kind of the idea playing in my head. And a short story is not a lot of, there's not a lot of room to do that level of a transition. So I really wanted some kind of shorthand for something that people wouldn't question, be like, oh, of course you would be religiously broken. And so my mind jumped back to that interview that I had listened to. And I thought, well, this adult in this future was a teenager in the Branch Davidian cult. And that's obviously why they're so broken. So I wrote this short story, and that's, I was just going to kind of let it go at that. And I kept, the short story was really well received, and I kept getting questions about the short story. In particular, there was a local writer in Indianapolis named Sarah Larson who bugged me religiously, if you'll pardon the pun, you know, about this. And she really wanted to know, the short story was set in this post-apocalyptic future, and it vaguely referenced whatever was the tipping point event in history, as people called it, the breaking of the world. And it didn't explain what it was, but it kept referencing it. And the story also throughout it had things that had to do with the Branch Davidians and David Koresh. And Sarah just kept after me about how much she wanted to know what had happened in the past with the breaking of the world and these people in the Branch Davidians. And eventually, quite honestly, I wasn't planning on writing a book. Enough people asked me questions that it just kept rolling around in my head, and I found myself wanting to do a book, and so I started doing research on it.
And so it sounds like you really, really connected with her.
Yeah, yeah.
And when you said that this was a story that you were commissioned to write that talks about faith in a dark way, was this one of the Dark Faith anthologies?
It was. We had put out a Dark Faith anthology, and basically I'd been approached with, we'd like you to, you know, because when you edit an anthology, generally speaking, unless you're Neil Gaiman or somebody like that, that can pull off being in your own anthology, you know, generally it's frowned upon to do that. So, when Maurice and I did the Dark Faith, anthologies, they were really well received. We were nominated First Oker Award, Black Quill Award, a couple other awards. And I was approached, because I was, you know, Maurice is a lot more productive as a writer than I am. I'm a slow writer. And so he had a lot more out there. And so I was approached, and asked, you know, we haven't seen anything from you in this space. We'd be really interested. Would you like to write a story for us, you know, in this area? And, you know, when somebody wants to pay you pro rates and commission a story, you never say no.
Yeah, I know, because I had someone actually reach out and say, hey, we would love for you to write an essay for this anthology that we're working on. And I was like, oh, okay, yeah, that's cool. And then I actually had to write it. And I'm like, whoa, essay writing is a little bit harder than I thought it was going to be. But there was money on the table.
So right. So, I actually had a short conversation with John Scalzi the other day. He has that column that he does on his website, the Big Idea, which if you've never checked it out, it's really terrific. Mm-hmm. He basically just invites people to, hey, you've got a book coming about, come in over to my audience, tell them about the Big Idea.
Yeah. Chuck Wendig does this.
Yeah, yeah. I'm addicted to them. I love reading them. I pick up a lot of books that way. But he got a hold of me and he's like, hey, Jerry, would you like to do one for Breaking the World? And immediately I was like, yes, absolutely. I would love to do one. And then I hit send and I'm like, crap. Now I've got to do one.
Now I got to write it.
Yeah.
And now I've got to go write it.
Well, that's awesome.
Yeah, no, that sounds great. You know, before we move into our next section of the show, I want to take a moment to thank everybody that backs the show over at patreon.com/functionalnerds. We couldn't do the show without you, and we really appreciate the support you give us every month by your pledges. And if you're someone who's not currently backing us, consider doing that by going over to patreon.com/functionalnerds. And now let's get on to the picks of the week.
Picks of the week.
And Jerry, do you have a pick to share with our audience?
I do. I actually decided to kind of pick one out of my favorite archive based on the fact that we were talking about my book today and about alternate history in general. My pick is The Sound of My Voice, which is a movie. I don't know if you're familiar with actor writer Britt Marling. She's got a show on Netflix called The OA.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So before she did that show, she did a movie called The Sound of My Voice. It's the exact same creative team, but the movie follows two investigative journalists that are infiltrating a cult surrounding a woman who claims to be from the year 2054. She claims to not only be from the future, but she's come back basically with a plan to alter the past in order to save the future. And the movie involves these two investigative journalists infiltrating the kind of cult surrounding this woman and trying to expose it, and finding it much more complicated than they expected.
Hmm. She also did, was it Other Earth?
Yeah, I haven't seen that. Is that good?
I haven't seen it either, but I believe it's the exact same creative team. I think she just uses the same people.
Okay.
Well, and they've done several projects together.
I enjoy the OA. It was a little kind of, it could use a little more focus and a little more concentration, I think. But this mm-hmm. is a very tight, gripping story. It's really enjoyable. I mean, I love time travel. I love alternate history. I love the apocalyptic themes, and they're all kind of rolled in there.
Yeah. Very cool.
Yeah, that's really cool. You know, I don't know if I've mentioned this on the show. It really doesn't paint me in a great light, but it's one of those kind of knowing somebody of note. So you mentioned Britt Marling and doing the OA, and I guess one of her writing partners on that is I don't know how to pronounce his last name. It's like Zal Bet. I can't pronounce. It's Batmanglig. And his brother did the music for the OA, and his brother is Rustam, and who was in a band, the Vampire Weekend, which, you know, pretty big indie band from a couple years ago. So he's much younger than I am, but the little story that I want to share is I had a band when I was in my early mid 20s, and the bass player in that band was a guy named Spencer Miles, and we used to rehearse at his house. And Spencer was a couple years younger than me. I think at the time he was probably only like 20 years old. And Spencer's, this is like a long convoluted thing, but Spencer's younger brother is this guy, Wes Miles, who was in another pretty well-known indie band at the time, which now I'm trying to think if I can find what his name is. Rah Rah Riot. That was the name of his indie band. Anyway, Wes and Rustam were like kids at the time. They were like 13, 14 years old. And while my band of people in their 20s was rehearsing, these two kids were just like sort of farting around with everyone's gear. And it was like sort of like a, hey, go away kid, like the cooler older kids are doing stuff. P.S. fast forward 10 years. And, you know, I and the other guys in that band have zero success. And these two little kids, both in pretty big indie bands with tons of records out. And now this other guy, Rostam, is scoring the OA. So yes, it doesn't paint me in a good light. But so I sort of remember this guy as like a 13-year-old farting around in the same basement that I was farting around in, and he became much more successful than I did. So there you go. But a little thing, because I remember when all that was coming out, I'm like, that's the same kid. I remember him. And that's so weird. Anyway, Patrick, what's your pick?
Well, we haven't really, really kind of delved into this or talked about it much. I think we did mention it back a few months ago. For my birthday, I bought myself a PS4.
Right. I remember when you were looking to buy one. Yeah.
Yeah. And it ended up, my birthday's in October, but I actually didn't buy it until November because that's when work did bonuses and all this kind of stuff. And I was able to afford it. So I bought it in November. So it's more of a Thanksgiving gift. And with that, I got Battlefront 2, which has been mired in controversy. And
loot crate.
Loot crates were causing all sorts of issues, and especially the microtransactions. And so when they launched the game, they took all of that out, all of the microtransactions. You couldn't buy stuff, right? You basically, if you bought the elite version of the game, you got a foot up on your troopers having some more stuff, and you got a couple of extra characters, but that was it. You couldn't, there was a lot of other stuff you couldn't do. And then they had this loot crate thing where you would have to earn credits in game and then use the credits to buy loot crates. And then you would get star cards and you use the star cards to upgrade. And it was just kind of a pain in the ass. Well, I read in Forbes in January that EA posted their fourth quarter info and basically said that they took a hit, but it wasn't as bad as they thought it was going to be because some of their other games continued to perform well. And so they were like, we're going to put all the microtransactions back. Screw everybody.
Oh, wow. Really?
Because they wanted to make the money, right? And then something happened between then and now because they completely changed their mind. And what they've done now is they've stripped all of that out. They just did a release, and that's kind of my pick. They released an update for the game that took out the loot crates and all that other stuff. Now you get a daily login loot crate that gives you 500 credits, and everybody gets 500 credits. And you, if you want to level up your heavy trooper, how you do that is you play your heavy trooper. And the more you play it, the more you're going to level it up, the more points you're going to get that you can put into star cards to upgrade the cards, which upgrades the gear. And it's now a sort of a, it's like every other game in the world, right? You have a character, you play the character, you level the character up.
Your D&D microtransactions. Character now. Yeah. Yep. Yeah.
And that is interesting to me. It's a little difficult because of all the different classes and characters. You have your regular soldier, your heavy soldier, or troopers, right? You have your regular trooper, your heavy trooper, your specialist trooper. You've got your officers, then you have all the different kind of ships, fighters, interceptors, speeders, armor, bombers. You have all your heroes, Boba Fett, Bosk, Darth Vader, all the way up and through. And then all their special ships, there's a special ship for Yoda, there's Poe Dameron, so on and so forth. If you want to level those up now, you have to play that particular character.
That's kind of cool.
The one thing that I liked, it is, but the one thing I did like is that you could get what were called crafting parts before. And the crafting parts could be spent anywhere you wanted. You didn't have to put them on a specific character. They were non-colored mana, right? They went anywhere you wanted them to go. Now, the only way to level up Yoda's ship is to play Yoda's ship, which means that you have to earn enough battle points in a battle to unlock the ship and then play the ship and hope you don't get killed. Because if you get killed, you're back to using a regular fighter, an interceptor, or a bomber until you get enough battle points again to unlock Yoda's ship. Does that make sense?
Yeah, yeah.
Now, so I think it's a step forward. I think it's a good step forward. I think it's going to help level the game a little bit and provide more fun. But the only limitation is on some of those in the battles themselves, you have to unlock the hero characters and hero ships in order to play them. And that can take time. And then sometimes you don't get to unlock the one you want to play and level up, if that makes sense. So anyway, go ahead.
Well, I was going to ask Patrick, did you play through, because I don't have it, but at some point I'd like to play it. Did you play through the whole story mode?
I'm halfway through chapter 2.
Okay, because I, from people that played it, that do some of the Star Wars podcasts that I listen to, and most of them aren't big gamers, so they're not necessarily super invested in all that. But the feedback that I've heard is that there is the story mode is good and does tell a nice connective story to canon. And even if you're not a huge gamer, it's worthwhile to play the story mode just to get the story.
Yes, I would agree with that.
If you're kind of invested in the Star Wars universe, it's a nice thing to do. So I know it's, I'll probably wait, you know, until I see it in the used bins for really cheap, and I'll probably just pick it up at that point and play through the story. But I heard the action is fun too. Like, it's, you know, it depends on what, you know, games have come so far since the time that I've played them that I'm so totally out of that world. And I know the criteria and the expectations from gamers about their games is so high compared to what I was used to playing many, many years ago, that I understand a lot of the, you know, the standards that these games are held to, and that the, and obviously all the loot crate stuff and everything, that was a big issue. But, you know, one of the things I also heard about that is that there's, it's very likely, or it's looking that Lucasfilm is not going to use EA.
Yeah.
For the next games, that they're going to maybe start partnering, because EA has kind of made big mistakes on the last two releases, and that they'd like to maybe go in a different direction. And
I can see them doing that. Yeah. The story mode is great. I enjoyed the story mode, and it takes you through a lot of the, you know, the movie canon, right? And does add to it. You get little snippets here and there of kind of what was going on in the background, right? And you see some of the major characters through Iden Versio's eyes and her experiences with them. So it is cool. And they also got some decent voice actors for it. And just like they did with The Force Unleashed, the character was based physically on the actor who was playing him.
Right.
Who I believe also was the voice of Darth Maul in the Clone Wars and in Rebels.
Oh, Sam Witwer, yeah. I believe is his name, yes.
So they got an actress, yeah. And she is they based the character of Iden on her, mm-hmm. And she's also the voice. And then they also had the guy who played Harry Dresden on the channel formerly known as Sci-Fi.
Oh,
he
was also an Arrow.
Yeah, he's also an Arrow. He's one of the voices on the show,
or
in there, one of the Imperial officers. So they definitely don't. I feel don't skimp on that. However, you can tell that like the focus of the rest of the game was on the loot crate system and the grinding.
Right.
And they've just shifted the grinding to something that is, I think, more palatable for most gamers. You know, you pick a character and you level them up.
And just to go with what you were saying about the actor playing the main role in this one, I know her name is, because I heard it on another podcast, her name is Janina Gavankar, and I haven't read it yet, but there's also a prequel novel written by, I think, Christopher Golden or Christy Golden. That now I'm going to
probably Christopher Golden.
Oh, yeah, I think that's who it was. Janina Gavankar does read the audiobook for that too. That's so if you end up really enjoying the story mode of the game, I think it's just called, you know, Battlefront 2. I don't know what the name of the novel is, but there is a novel that is sort of a prequel for her where she's the point of view character and she reads it. So that's, if you end up enjoying the game, that might be an audiobook that you may want to check out, Patrick. So,
well, and the other thing is right now they only have a handful of locations, and they promised to add more as well, which I think is going to be good, because right now it's like, oh yeah, here I am again.
Yeah.
I'm going to do this one again.
I would be interested to know the kind of first, the single player story, how long that is, because I've got a nephew that has the game. It's just absolutely gorgeous to look at. And I love games, but I have a game problem. I have a hugely addictive personality when it comes to games. So a game like that's got a nice closed loop story to it, I can get that kind of game on vacation, play through it, enjoy it, and then let it go. But if it's some of these games that just they go on and on and on, I mean, I'd never get anything done.
Awesome. Awesome. All right. Well, my pick, I'm sort of going between two. So, you know what? I'll ask you, Patrick, would you rather me do a book pick or a TV show pick?
Book.
Okay. So the book that I finished recently, I've been a little bit on a kick of these rock biographies and autobiographies. And one that I finished a few weeks ago is Running with the Devil, a backstage pass to the Wild Times, Loud Rock, and the Down and Dirty Truth Behind the Making of Van Halen. And it's written by Noel E. Monk, who was their manager through the entire David Lee Roth era of the band. And as people know, I read a lot of books about, you know, self-improvement and stoicism and meditation and all these things. And I find that these rock biographies are good, besides the fact that they're just easy reads and they're entertaining and all of that kind of stuff. They're actually just very good. Here's an example of what not to do with your life. because I just finished this one and I'm in the middle of The Dirt, the Motley Crue autobiography right now. And that one's really crazy, but I'm not done with that one yet. But the Van Halen one, and I'm a pretty big Van Halen fan. You will not like them as much after you read this book, because like I said, it's written from their manager who, you know, big surprise, they screwed him over in the end, you know. But it's really, he lived with them every day on tour during those first, you know, five albums up through 1984 or however many albums it was, and just lived a crazy lifestyle. And, you know, from watching some of these rock documentaries, I don't know if I was just really naive. Obviously, you knew that drugs were a big part of a lot of these bands' lives. But after reading these books and watching these documentaries, it's like, yeah, every guy in every one of these bands had a hellacious drug problem.
Well, there's always that guy who hangs around and just, you know, oh yeah, you want some pills? Here you go. You want some blow? You want some blah 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 blah.
Yeah, so there's a lot of that going on, and just destructive. Just, you know, the whole wrecking hotel rooms and everything. And, you know, look, again, this is from this guy's point of view, so where the truth lies, who knows? But at this point, this is, you know, 30 years after the fact, so it's like, it's probably pretty accurate, you know. I wouldn't doubt it. But
everything I've ever seen about Eddie Van Halen said that he was just an absolute bastard back in the day.
Well, he just seemed really out of it too. Like, he was like super big drinker, super into coke, and just, you know.
Well, and he would play guitar with his back to the audience because he didn't want people stealing his technique.
That was an early thing before they broke. Yeah, but that was a thing. And yeah, it's basically, you walk away from Michael Anthony, the bass player, was the only good guy in the band. David Lee Roth was crazy and super narcissist, egoist.
That just sounds so out of character.
Yeah, and then Eddie Van Halen is kind of sort of portrayed as being kind of a sweet guy who just got too wrapped up in the drinking and the drugs, and that really kind of warped his brain. And Alex Van Halen does not come off well in this. He kind of comes out as maybe the biggest dick of them all, like, just in really? Terms of, yeah, which I was kind of surprised at, because
I almost would think of him as the, like, I'm just happy to be here guy.
Yeah, no, he wasn't. He was there. There seemed to be some jealousy that his brother was getting a lot of the attention, and, you know, and they had an alcoholic father, so that never helps. And, you know, so that was the whole thing. And it's, if you're one who enjoys these kind of, you know, rock biographies, it's not the, like I said, it's written by the manager, so it's like not the best writing in the world, and it's not, I'm sure.
Is it better than Sean Penn's?
I never read Sean Penn, so I don't know. But
I've just seen the excerpts of that. It's pretty scary.
Wow. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm from what you're saying, it sounds better than that. No, this is a professionally edited book that, you know, tells a story, but it's essentially like, this was this year and on this tour, and then he just tells a bunch of stories from that tour, and, you know, so it's it is what it is. But if you like this kind of thing, it's worth reading. And especially if you're a big, if you're into Van Halen, it's worth just to kind of get the behind the scenes. Cause I must have read, you know, 50 articles with Eddie Van Halen when I was in high school, you know, just cause he'd be interviewed in all the guitar magazines whenever a new album came out. So it's interesting to get this other perspective on what was going on. It's like, wow, that's crazy that they were doing all that at the time. So
it's hilarious that you picked this, because recently I was listening to Spotify and I was on like a random channel where it just picks things and feeds them to me. And one of the songs was a Van Halen song, one of the old Van Halen songs. And it was Hot for Teacher. And I flashed back to, I remember driving with someone who, when that song came on, they got very angry and they turned it off. They hated that song. And I could not remember who it was that hated that song. I just remembered the moment of them turning it off and saying, "Ugh, I hate that song." And so I was texting a couple people and I'm like, "Hey, do you like Van Halen?" And someone texted back, "I like Van Hagar."
Yeah, this doesn't get into that because this manager was gone once David Lee Roth left.
Yeah.
Yeah, so and I am actually
Was he just a gigolo?
Yes, he was. I am actually one of the rare people that really likes both eras of the band. I just consider them different bands. They were very different bands. Jerry, do you have any Van Halen opinions?
I actually was a DJ for a radio station at a very young age. My voice was this at this level at about the age of 13. And so I got a job in high school working for a radio station, was a huge Van Halen fan. As a result of working for the station, I got a lot of backstage time, a lot of VIP pass time. Ooh. And I've seen that bad behavior, not hanging out with the band, but, you know, hanging out adjacent to the band, I guess I should say.
So Jerry, were you hot Donna?
I was not hot Donna. I wanted to be.
Now, was this David Lee Roth era or Sammy Hagar era?
This was the tail end of David Lee Roth. This was David Lee Roth spinning out of control.
Yeah, that's apparently by the end, it was crazy. Like that last, like the 1984 tour was... It's miraculous that they made such a good album because they were in such turmoil at the time and they were so drug addled at the time that it's amazing that that album is as good as it is because it kind of has no right to be.
Actually, you're talking about how this, you know, kind of lowered your opinion of them. Maybe I just recently watched a documentary on Twisted Sister and
great doc.
Yeah.
I've been wanting to watch
It's terrific. Yeah. And Dee Snider is doesn't do drugs, doesn't drink. And so it's a really interesting view of that entire culture just because he's literally the only guy coming at it sober.
Right.
Wow.
What I love about that doc is it is their whole career right before they broke. It's like two. It's a pretty long doc too. I feel like it's like 2+ out, maybe it's not, but I remember being kind of long, and it's right up until they have their success. It's essentially their decade of playing clubs in the tri-state area, particularly Long Island, and them having a great career as a local live band. And
right.
Yeah. So that's a really interesting point of view from a documentary, but you're right, because being sober, he was the guy that like really understood it, and he's still out there doing his thing too. You gotta give him props because he still does his thing. But
I forget what the year is. I posted something the other week about it was the anniversary of his he went before Congress to testify back in the 80s during the PMRC thing where they were trying to restrict record labels.
And
you know they kind of. He was viewed as a joke, and they invited him in basically like a lamb to be slaughtered, with no idea that you know he was actually intelligent and articulate. And if you want to see something interesting, if you're a fan of music, you can go and find it on YouTube. He just basically takes about a half hour and demolishes their entire argument.
I remember that lady that was like doing that and was the driving force behind all that. And then him going in there and just doing an amazing job.
Yeah. I mean, and he's in like sunglasses with big hair and jeans, mm-hmm. and he made a whole theater thing out of it. He, you know, his speech was in his back pocket, folded up like it was, you know, late homework to be turned in, and no, he just demolished them. It was terrific.
Yeah, I believe, I don't know if it's the same time period, but I think there's also clips of Frank Zappa kind of doing the same thing where Zappa got in there and, mm-hmm. you know, kind of gave it to him pretty good. So, yeah, I think they just thought it was all these, you know, crazy, you know, unintelligent rock stars. And then you had Dee Snider and Frank Zappa go in there and give it to him pretty good. Yeah. So, yeah, that was interesting times for sure. It's a. You know, that was a big theme, but
on the opposite side of the spectrum, if you look on YouTube, there is a video of Fred Rogers.
Oh yeah, I've seen that. That's phenomenal.
In Congress.
That is phenomenal.
Yes, where they were going to defund or strip the funding from public television, and he went in and he did his Mr. Rogers thing on Congress. And it's an amazing video because he just sits there and he talks and he never loses his temper. He never raises his voice. He just talks about why he does what he does and how he does what he does and the importance of teaching, you know, children that about friendship and community.
How to handle your anger.
All that stuff. And it's an amazing video. Amazing video. Opposite side of the spectrum, but kind of the same in that I don't think that they expected him to be able to speak so eloquently and essentially reverse the opinions of the guy who was there to question him, which was awesome.
Cool. All right. Well, yeah, that was our main topic for sure. That's what we're No, that's totally cool. So Jerry, but as
we warned you, Jerry.
Yeah, no, it's
we warned you.
But Jerry, you know, to kind of wrap it up here, you know, we talked about it in the beginning, but why don't you, you know, again, tell people your book, your title, what they can expect, when it's out, what format it's going to be out in, and all that good stuff.
Sure. Well, the book's Breaking the World. It's an alternative or an alternate, depending upon how you want to phrase that, history apocalyptic thriller that takes place during the 51-day standoff between the federal government and the Branch Davidian Church in Waco, Texas. The novel itself starts out very closely aligned with history, kind of gives you an inside feel of what it would be like to live through those events. And then slowly it starts to kind of move away from that into a more fictional area. So it's available for pre-order now at apexbookcompany.com, and it will be released on April 19th. It is in hardcover, it's in trade paperback, it's in ebook, and very soon it will be an audiobook.
Sweet. And do you have any conventions that you're going to be going to in the coming months?
Yes. Actually, starting next month, I will be at MoCon, which is in Indianapolis. And then following that, I believe it's Nikon and Gen Con and then Imaginarium and Worldcon. I believe that.
Do you know the way to San Jose?
What was that again?
I said, do you know the way to San Jose?
I got the feeling I'm going to have driven everywhere but there by the end of this, by the end of this year. So,
yeah, you got a heavy con schedule. A lot of times when I ask that question at the end, people are like, yeah, I got this one that I might go to. I'm not sure. Like you're out there pounding the pavement.
No, I'm leaving a couple out and a couple of, smaller cons or face-to-face interviews that I'll be traveling to go to. So yeah, I'm kind of going to be everywhere this year. I'll be sick of myself.
See, I think the Indianapolis crew needs to drive to Denver for Mile High Con.
I would love to. I love Denver. Denver is terrific.
Yeah. And it's a great little con.
So my only problem with that is that, I'm not sure I'm going to want to stay in the hotel for the con. I'm going to want to go enjoy Denver. It's like there's a horror author named Rath James White who used to live in Las Vegas and throws con and I knew him and knew his wife, and they went, well, you should come out for the con. And it's like, this is who stays for a con in Las Vegas?
Well, that's why you do the thing that people do for Worldcon. You know, they come in a few days before and they stay a few days later, and they do the sightseeing thing.
Where was Worldcon? Was it Iceland that it was at?
There was London.
Reykjavik. I don't know. There was.
Oh yeah, there was. Yeah, there was one in. I know what you're talking about. Yes, there was one somewhere over there, and people did that. It like took 2 weeks.
I was at a con with Anne Vandermeer as a guest, and we're talking about it. And I'm like, well, I don't know. She's like, oh, I've got family over there. You just stay with us. And I'm like, and I'm not like torn. It's like, that is such an awesome offer. And at the same time, I have like a little one at home. I don't think I can be gone for that long.
Well, Patrick, when is the Denver con that you were just talking about?
October 19, 20, and 21 this year.
Okay. Are there any cons in the Denver, Colorado area in the summer? Or is that...
When's my... Well, you got Denver Comic Con.
When's that?
I don't remember.
Okay.
June or July, I want to say.
Okay.
You also have... Well, I think Anomaly Con's done. They don't do that anymore. Okay. There's a couple different ones. I can look them up for you.
Okay.
I would love to get you guys to Indianapolis for Gen Con. I think you would have so much fun there. You'd be blown away by the size.
I have been wanting to go to Gen Con for a while now, and I definitely want to do their writer's track because I hear that it's just an amazing experience, and I definitely want to do that. It's just a matter of being able to go and do
right.
That.
When you're ready to do that, come talk to me because it's a local con for me. Which makes it sound small.
It's not. It's huge.
So you have the con itself, which is, you know, it's role playing games, board games, video games.
I don't love any of that.
Yeah,
stuff.
You don't love any of that stuff at all. The Writer Symposium is a thing that's kind of, it's part of the con, but it's adjacent to it. To give you an idea how big Gen Con is, it not only takes up our entire convention center in downtown, which is huge. It takes over every single hotel in downtown.
Mm.
So you might be in the convention center, you might be in a neighboring hotel, that sort of thing. They issue tickets for even free events. So a lot of the writers' panels are free, but you still, you sign up that you want to go to a panel, and it allows them to kind of track what people are interested in. Last year, the Writer Symposium had 10,000 tickets sold for panels.
Yeah.
That's how big it is.
When I got in deep with Pikes Peak Writers Conference, and I was doing a lot with them, is when I kind of became aware of Gen Con's Writers Symposium, and I was just blown away by the interest that it was generating just from fans, you know, because you don't usually see that. Even you go to Denver Comic Con, they have writers tracks and they're great, and you're in these rooms with people that you enjoy talking with. And then you look out at the crowd and there's 20 people sitting there in a room that will host, you know, 150.
Right, right.
Yeah. And so it's like most people are in the main stage trying to see Stan Lee.
Yeah.
Not trying to see, you know, me and four other authors talking.
And I've been on panels with really big names there that are packed, you know, 500 people, and they're packed in and they're packed in for whatever name. But I've been on panels at Gen Con at 8 a.m. on a Thursday with no name participants, and there are 150 people in the audience.
That's awesome.
That are there with notebooks. Like, okay, you're going to tell me how to write a book, right?
Sit your butt down, put your fingers on the keys, and start typing.
There you go.
That's all there is to it. Well, that's awesome, Jerry. I'm glad you have so much going on. And yeah, maybe we'll try to get out there at some point. For us, once again, if you dig what we're doing, consider becoming one of our backers over at patreon.com/functionalnerds. Patrick, anything you want to leave our listeners with today?
Yes, I have this 30-minute thing I want to read. So
sit back.
Now that's it. I'm good.
All right, everybody. Have a great week. Jerry, thank you for joining us. We really appreciate it.
Always a pleasure, guys.
All right, everyone, have a good one.
Gunsmoke. I'd like to say thank you on behalf of the group and ourselves, and I hope we pass the audition.
Still here? It's over. Go home. Go.
Would you like a chili, baby?
I'm the one in the middle.